This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Well, Dad's German, Mom, Chinese. Daughter Emily is often asked, "What are you?" What does Emily make of the question? She may pose her own. What kind of culture cuts people into mixtures and halves? Emily could call herself a fusion. That thumbnail scenario is a boiled-down condensation of the opening of the new book, America Beyond Black and White, How Immigrants and Fusions Are Helping Us Overcome the Racial Divide. The author, Ronald Fernandez. Ronald Fernandez is our guest in this portion of the program. He joins us to talk about the ways in which we view race and ethnicity in America, how that's changing, and how these changes could help us, as the title of his book suggests, overcome the racial divide. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Ronald Fernandez, who has requested that I call him Ronnie, thank you, is a professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Central Connecticut State University. He earned his PhD in sociology at the University of Connecticut. In addition to America Beyond Black and White, Ronnie Fernandez is one of the authors of Puerto Rico, Past and Present, and Encyclopedia. His new book, America Beyond Black and White, How Immigrants and Fusions Are Helping Us Overcome the Racial Divide, is published by the University of Michigan Press as part of its series in contemporary political and social issues. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else? Toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, the 333-9455 number, good in the Champaign-Urbana area. Ronnie Fernandez, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure to speak with you this afternoon. It seems to me, after, you know, looking through your book and thinking about this, is maybe what we should do is maybe all of us could call ourselves fusions.
Well, that's certainly the suggestion that I make at the conclusion of the book, that we're all American fusions, because we're all a combination of all of the people who, for lack of a better way to explain it, have been making love with one another since life began in Africa.
Yeah, that's a nice way of thinking about it, isn't it?
Well, excuse me, there's a book by Douglas Palmer called 6 Million Years, and Palmer talks about folks in the West Islands of Scotland who have DNA both from Portugal and Finland. But when they trace the Finnish back, it actually originated in Siberia. And when they trace the Portuguese DNA back, it actually originated in Mongolia. People crossed the Bering Straits, came down to what's today Brazil, brought it from Brazil over to Portugal, and then up to Scotland. That would be my definition of humanity. We're all fusions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think of myself off the top of my head as Irish-American or American-Irish. But when I think about Ireland, though, I have to think of all the people that got to that place over time.
Right, right. Be very similar, I think, to the results in Scotland. Carlos Fuentes points out that roughly 25% of the words in the Spanish language are of African and Arab origin. So since my family, for example, comes from Spain on both sides, a good part of me would be African.
Now, when someone, I used the, you know, you opened the book with this little story about this.
Emily Hammerstein, right?
Emily, excuse me. When someone like Emily calls herself a fusion, what is she saying about race and ethnicity?
Well, the question that she gets, or the book is dedicated to my grandson, who's also a fusion, she gets the question constantly, what are you? So she raises the idea that she's a walking contradiction to the way in which we've been taught to see race and ethnicity. So the alternatives for her, she can be mixed, she can be half, God help us, she can be a half-breed, but there really aren't many positive ways for her to describe herself. So fusion is a way in which these youngsters are about 2.5% of our population, the so-called mixed race, youngsters, about 7 million of them, and many of the younger ones have begun to use fusion as a positive way to describe themselves. It's a rejection of the culture. And certainly a rejection of this question that they get constantly, what are you? Which is, in many cases, an affront.
Yeah. It's kind of surprising that we're, on the one hand, that we're asking that question still.
Well, it cuts through the literature of all of the groups. We were with my daughter-in-law at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She is Colombian, and the other side of her is Japanese. We're just looking at the pictures, and some man came up to her, tapped her on the shoulder, and asked her, "What are you?" Her face just doesn't fit into the black-white dichotomy, and the individual was so rude that he had to know. But that's a constant for these youngsters.
Yeah. One of the things that you say early in the book is that that these fusions, they want to instigate a mutiny. And you also say a cultural mutiny is already underway.
Right.
What does this mutiny mean for the country?
Well, hopefully it's a very positive thing, because this is a very optimistic book arguing that it's possible, thanks to the immigrants and the fusions, to have a radical reconfiguration of the culture. We have approximately 50 million people, Latinos, so-called Asians, Arabs, Indians, Caribbean folks, who crash, in a computer sense, our operating system of beliefs about race and ethnicity. Many Indians or Pakistanis or Bangladeshis are darker than African Americans, but we wouldn't call them black. So what in heaven's name are they? According to the Census Bureau, Arabs, or actually anyone from North Africa, is white, which means, from that point of view, that the people who committed 9/11 were white. That's an obviously ridiculous conclusion, but it's only ridiculous in the context of the various concepts that the Census Bureau uses. So it seems to me that the Arabs are doing us, or folks from North Africa, a great favor, because they're saying, my God, the way in which you people have learned to think is a bit bizarre and silly.
Yeah. How does the U.S. Census ask about race and ethnicity?
Well, you can be black, you can be white. According to the census, for example, Japanese is a race. People from Guam are a race. It's really quite crazy in terms of how we've learned to think about it. Historically, folks from North Africa were not white. Then the Census Bureau changed its mind. Mexicans in 1930, for example, were a race. Now they're Hispanic others. The basic problem is that these individuals, say for argument's sake, someone from, excuse me, India, cannot fit into the white-black dichotomy. So they tend to call themselves, for example, nowhere men or nowhere women. And they're asking us, or they're giving us the opportunity to ask, if the words that we've been taught to use make any sense.
Yeah.
For example, Asians, Latinos, and Arabs are people of color. But if that's the case, then white people have no color, even though they and everyone else calls them white, right?
Yeah.
So white's not a color, but people of color only exist in relation to white people who did not get a color because they were white, which is not a color. If that's not crazy, I don't know what is, but in a serious sense, it's the way in which we've been taught to think, and the book is arguing in a variety of different chapters about the Asian population, about the Chicano population, that we have to rethink this. One of the fears of the book is that in reaction to this, people are starting to further define themselves by what divides us. Chicano is by definition an anti-American word and one invented in this country in reaction to a great extent to not being able to fit into the black-white dichotomy.
Mm.
I mean, there are a variety of other factors, but...
Yeah. When and how did the word fusion come into use in this manner?
Well, I attended the 2004 conference in Claremont, California. It was an intercollegiate conference of, they were calling themselves, mixed-race youngsters, mixed-race Americans. And I, for the first time, heard it there. And then redefined it, if you will, in the course of researching and writing the book. But that was something that the students were using for themselves to redefine themselves.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Ronnie Fernandez, author of America Beyond Black and White, How Immigrants and Fusions Are Helping Us Overcome the Racial Divide. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener joining us from the campus of the University of Illinois. Line one, hi.
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 This is a really important discussion, and I think in discussing the U.S. Census categories, you can get a long way towards discussing race here on campus. I'm a teaching assistant, so it's often difficult to talk about these categories because, as the guest is pointing out, it's not even comparing apples and oranges when you have a category such as whiteness, which is arguably a form of property, as Cheryl P. Harris has argued in a law journal. And then you have a category called Asian, which applies to people supposedly, I guess, on the eastern part of Istanbul to Taiwan. Not a very category that I'm placed in often, but doesn't really tell you very much. And then, of course, what the author is pointing to is that our racial system is so dependent on a black-white binary that it really has to point us towards our legacy of slavery.
And exactly.
Even more recently, the 1924 Virginia Racial Integrity Law is what established the rule of one drop. So whereas my colleagues in from Ghana would not necessarily consider Colin Powell black in their racial system because of our legacy of a very bad moment in U.S. history that keeps to continually being reenacted on this campus through other 1920s festivities, is a real challenge to teachers in the classroom. So I think if people can maybe divest themselves from whiteness a little bit, they can see that perhaps that genomic discourse helps. If everyone kind of says, oh, we're all from Africa, so we're all the same. But unfortunately, that's an easy way to dodge the responsibility towards the historical legacy. And as for a legacy of making love, I would also argue that was also a legacy of rape and genocide. Mm.
Yes, in some cases, certainly.
Okay.
Can I make two quick points?
Sure.
Well, one is that, and I think this is obvious, white people don't exist. The vast majority of people called white in this world are beige. I've never met you, Celeste, nor have you met me, but I would bet that both of us are beige, which is light brown. So it's this absurdity of calling something which is not white, white. Excuse me. The other side of that the caller was making, which I think is an important point, here in Connecticut we have a tremendous population of West Indians, vast majority being Jamaicans. When they get off the plane in Kennedy, they see themselves as Jamaicans. And suddenly they're told that they're black. In Jamaica, they certainly see skin color. But their ethnic identity is the core of who a Jamaican is. It's a wonderful thing to see Jamaican pride. excuse me. But they come here, and at our university, for example, we have a Caribbean club where many of the Jamaican youngsters will go because they're not black. And the black youngsters will tell the Jamaican youngsters, yes, you are black. And the Jamaican youngster says, no, I'm not. I'm Jamaican. And this, we create this battle. And Jamaicans are telling us, again, the theme of the book, that you can be dark-colored and not see color. It's not really important. It's a peripheral consideration in Jamaica. They tend to be mean to one another on issues of social class, but not on color.
Mm. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi there. My adopted kids are multiracial. I think they span four continents. But my daughter and my son seem to have had different experiences in their growing up years and socializing through the schools and so forth. And I wondered if you could speak to anything about the difference between, I don't know, the glamour and exoticism of mixed race females versus the racism perceived as a black guy of mixed race men.
Well, I think it's a common problem in our family as well, with my daughter-in-law, who often receives this comment, exotic. One thing I do is that there's a great web page called Eurasian Nation, where a lot of the kids, perhaps a couple of hundred now, have put biographical statements online, both men and women, trying to explain their experiences in our country. The women often get the exotic thing, which, when the guys come on to them, is usually regarded by the woman, at least in one I've read and seen, in a very negative fashion, because, they stick out rather than just being like the rest of us. The men, I think the experience is going to vary a great deal, on where they come from. But if this helps, in the recent Pew Research Center report on black sea growing values gap between poor and middle classes, one of the things that I think speaks to the point that the book is making, on page 7, I have it in front of me, they talk about Tiger Woods as an African-American. The man has indicated repeatedly he's not, and that he's a Calabasian because he's got, of course, the Chinese and the Native American and the Thai background. But we keep trying to squeeze these folks into categories and won't let them embrace or celebrate all the aspects of their humanity.
Mm. Maybe we could go back to the first caller and a point that she raised, which also is something that you raise in the book, America Beyond Black and White. And this is, you know, one of the hopeful opportunities that we have here. The legacy of slavery. We can challenge this legacy. We can look at it, examine it, and say, well, it's still with us. How do we explode it?
Exactly. I mean, the argument of the book is that the longest-lasting ideological legacy of slavery is the white-black dichotomy, which, again, defines us by what divides us. And one of the questions, again, that the book tries to pose is how can we ever be colorblind if we continue to use white and black as crucial social identities? It's a contradiction in terms. What happens in the Chicano community, for example, is that they'll often refer to themselves as trigueño, or wheat-colored, or bronze people, and we perpetuate the color thing. Richard Rodriguez did a superb book called Brown. The subject is that race is a nonsensical category, and we should abolish it, but yet uses, again, color to define us. So hopefully we can move beyond that and begin to ask a series of questions. For example, why in heaven's name, if white people supposedly don't like darker-skinned people, do so many of us spend so much money going to have ourselves kind of spray-washed at tanning salons? And what in heaven's name is the shade that's apparently sexually attractive and the one that moves you into the negative black category? It's really crazy. It seems to me the immigrants are the ones who are allowing us to look into the mirror and say, my goodness, the way we've been taught to think is really absurd.
Yeah. In there in Connecticut, occasionally you ask people this question, what is white? What kind of responses do you get to that exercise?
Well, here there's a definite in Connecticut. Certainly Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, white is anyone, you've drawn a circle around Europe, and anyone in that circle would be white. So that's the answer you'll get virtually all of the time. When you point out to folks that they're not in fact white, that sometimes gets a bewildering reaction from them. Well, what in heaven's name is he talking about? If I was to tell you that a blue wall is actually red, you'd say I have perceptual problems. If I tell you a beige person is white, you don't. And you can start to move people, hopefully, in a positive way to ask questions. But again, here, we would just basically draw the circle around Europe. And that's what we did in 1924, when we closed out the world. One of the arguments of the book also, please, is that the melting pot is a myth.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of embracing the world, we excluded the vast majority of it who were supposedly non-white.
Yeah.
And it's Albert Murray who makes the point that in those lousy eight letters, non-white, are all the assumptions of white supremacy and segregation. White supremacy in the sense that white is the original, the designer original against which people of color exist, and segregation in the sense that whites can't marry, make, you know, have families with anybody who's not white.
Yeah. The melting pot is a myth, and you say, and it is a myth that stands in the way to us pulling together as a nation.
Right, because, I mean, the first folks we excluded systematically were the Chinese in 1882, and then we did that to a number of other individuals. There's a lovely case, in a perverse sense. In 1913, a fellow named Hamas Shahid, Syrian, South Carolina, goes into the courtroom. The judge calls him walnut-colored, and he points out that he wants to be a citizen. The question, of course, is he white? The speculation as to what he is. He points out that he comes from the land where Jesus Christ originated. Say no to me, you're saying no to Christ. And they nonetheless said no to him because he wasn't white. So a Christian nation effectively says no to Jesus Christ. It's pretty absurd.
Yeah. Also, I think one of the opportunities that this discussion presents us is that we can think about the transformation for the better that happens when people of different cultural experiences come into contact with one another.
Exactly. American sociology in particular has always stressed assimilation, becoming similar. Why in heaven's name would an Indian, for example, Indian, want to assimilate into a culture which effectively doesn't see them in a positive way? But one of the things I hopefully learned in various trips to Cuba was that they embraced cultural creativity and understood that when different cultures come together for for periods of time, you get cultural creativity. Maybe an example which I think you might have been alluding to. I love to watch the cooking channel, and particularly my children with the Iron Chef nonsense. But right? But the thing that we celebrate are the fusions of different food traditions and the creativity of the individual in creating something new. So instead of looking at the United States as everybody's got to become similar, we have this fantastic opportunity to move forward on the basis of different words. Fusion is supposed to be one of those new words that directs us forward. I mean, it rejects the concept of race. There's one race, the human race, and we're all in it.
Yeah.
It refuses to see skin color as a basic category of identity.
Yeah.
Excuse me. A fusion would see different body types or different somatic differences as a cause for celebration, excitement, interest, rather than something which moves me to segregate myself from other people.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the food channel, and, you know, there has been a movement, I don't know how current it is at this instant, but for fusion cooking.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
It's all over the country. So, naturally, I hadn't thought of that when I first began to write it, but for one reason or another, our children are fascinated by the program, so we've been forced to endure it on numerous occasions. And no, but it's exactly the point. The Cubans will sometimes talk about Santeria, which is the combination of Nigerian and Christianity religions. I love the notion that when Ricky Ricardo in the 50s is singing Babalu, that he's actually singing to Babaluaye, the Nigerian Orisha, who is actually in Cuba now, Saint Lazarus. They kind of put a wall in front of him so that people wouldn't recognize who he really was. But that's that cultural creativity that we can celebrate. The ethnic food aisles. Remember being in Albuquerque, going for a cup of coffee, and the fellow in front of me asked for a Whopper, no sauce. I thought that was a little strange coming from Connecticut. He wanted green salsa, and they took out of a plastic container Mexican fire, put it on his all-American hamburger, and you had something new.
Yeah.
That, I think, is, in a serious sense, the tremendous opportunity that we have as a culture to rethink the way we've been taught to see one another and then move into the future on a corrected past.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Ronnie Fernandez, author of America Beyond Black and White, How Immigrants and Fusions Are Helping Us Overcome the Racial Divide. Ronnie Fernandez, Ronnie Fernandez, there we go, is a professor in the Department of...
I'm glad you did it, not me.
...is a professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Central Connecticut State University. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What do you think about the campaign for president this time out and the candidacy of Barack Obama?
Well, Barack Obama appears on page 2 of the book as an individual who, given his ethnicity, forces us to ask these questions. The dad comes from Africa, the mom's from the United States, but people want to squeeze him, and I think he goes back and forth on whether he's black. The question that the book would ask would, if, for example, Obama calls himself black, is that a good thing? If the black-white categories are as divisive as I argue they are, and as poisonous in terms of the culture as they are, why would we want to create more black people or more white people? One of the scary things, for example, in Miami, is that, at least the Pew studies, 55% of Cubans, the only Latino group to do this, 55% of Cubans identify as white. From my perspective, that's a very negative assimilation. We don't need more white people. They don't exist in the first place. Again, it's very different. You don't see that among the Puerto Ricans. You don't see it among the Dominicans. Certainly, Chicanos wouldn't think along those lines. But Cubans here do. Cubans there, it's a different story.
Yeah. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times, a column by Frank Rich recently on Obama's candidacy and what it means for the GOP. And Mr. Rich seems to think that this candidacy, and if he wins the nomination, would really force the GOP to engage. What do you think?
Well, that's certainly possible. I guess it depends on what you mean by engage. If you mean to pander to the African-American constituency to vote, that would be a negative thing. If it meant, for example, actually confronting some of the absurdities of our civilization in terms of the words that we use to describe one another, that, it seems to me, would be a wonderful thing. From my perspective, for example, in the book, since I deny the concept of race and argue that we have to have a national dialogue not about race relations but about the concept of race, it's a ridiculous word. Senator Obama is, like any of us, a fusion, in his case, of African, and I believe the dad is from Kenya, Kenyan and American ethnicities. He's not black. And he's certainly not African-American, not in the sense that the word would be used if you're referring to individuals who were born here and had the particular experiences that come with it.
Yeah. What do you think about some of the media attention that we've seen in terms of, you know, is he too white for black voters, too black for white voters?
I would hope that he's doing, I think, an excellent job of trying to deal with some of those questions. But from the perspective of the book that I've done, I would hope he would move beyond that and say there's only one race, the human race. That's all there is. And let's talk about that fact and stop trying to define me by what divides me from other Americans, but start to define me by what unites me. We're all members of the human race, and we're all Americans, and let's see how we can move together to create a different future, one that's more equitable and just.
Yeah. As you quote the progressive essayist early in the book, I think at the close of the introduction, Randolph Byrne.
Oh, yes, it's a marvelous question.
What shall we do with our America?
Right, and one of the arguments of the book is, again, have a national dialogue about the stupidity of the concept of race. That's a 10 or a 20-year thing because it's so deeply rooted in the culture and so many individuals absolutely refusing to give it up.
Yeah, that's a good question. Why do we hang on to it?
Well, somebody like Manning Marrabel, African-American author, great stature, argues that he actually says it's an obscene concept, but it's the way in which we've been taught to see one another. Some of the sociologists argue that it's so rooted in the culture, you can't change it. But since virtually everyone agrees that race is a social construct, not a biological fact, the book is arguing that's a revolutionary insight. We don't have to accept this thing. We can use different words to describe ourselves. The notion that reality is socially constructed puts the power to reconstruct it in Celeste or Ronnie's hands.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Yes, this is a very interesting, and I must say I agree with you wholeheartedly, sir, that
race is a
social construct. I think the human genome experiment shows that race
Absolutely.
Has nothing to do with biology and science. But I have to wonder, as I listen to your talk, even though I've bought into whatever you say, I'm African American, I'm a light-complected African American from Arkansas. So, however, as I grew up in Arkansas doing Jim Crow, I was subject to all the indignities of Jim Crow. Because everybody there who looked at me, as well as looking at the darkest African American that was in my neighborhood, they saw me as being black and under white supremacy as being inherently inferior. My question to you is this: as long as the evil, and I'm underscoring the word evil, of white supremacy exists in this country, which I think it has from the get-go, what chances do we have of adopting a society that is not obsessed with race?
Well, I think that each of us can, first of all, it's going to be exceedingly difficult, quite obviously. You and I are talking, I agree with, it's evil, it's awful, it's despicable. But there's 500 years of it that essentially we're trying to erase. Obviously, that's not going to occur overnight. But I think that each of us can refuse to use the words black and white. You basically train your mind to watch your mouth. So if I was to meet you, I might say African American, but I would train my mind to the extent that it's possible to never refer to myself as a white person or to you as a black person. If you multiply that out by millions of people simply doing that, drawing a day, over a period of time, you can begin to see a revolution. Again, I'm talking about one in terms of the way in which we think, not the institutionalized inequalities which exist in Arkansas or in Hartford, Connecticut, where I live, as a result of the prejudice. But it seems to me, first and foremost, the revolution has to begin in our minds. And if you say that the words white and black are really stupid, first of all, they were invented by slave traders in the 1450s. Why in heaven's name would any of us want to use words invented by some of the most awful people in history?
Yes, sir. But thank you, sir.
I'm sorry. Did you want to say?
Are you cutting me off, Celeste?
No, I'm not. I'm not cutting you off at all, sir. So come back in for a follow-up.
Well, my follow-up is, once again, I'm probably speaking from my historical perspectives in this country, And the trying to be as pragmatic as about this and tending to believe you're idealistic, even though I wish what you said was as much of the truth, not only in theory but in practice in this country. But still, I'm very disheartened after being in this country for 59 and a half years, coming from an impoverished southern rural family of African Americans, now reaching the pinnacle of now being a retired law professor from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And all the way, I've always felt that I was being subordinated because of my race and this concept of white privilege or white supremacy, and I'm very disillusioned by that phenomenon.
Well, if I can, I'm 63, mm-hmm. and growing up in Brooklyn with my last name, I was always a spick.
Right.
None of the ugliness that you would have seen in Arkansas.
The N-word that was used indiscriminately, right.
But, excuse me, but I still think that you either retain that sense of revolution or we give in to that sense of disillusionment. Some of the awful things that we're seeing here in Connecticut, for example, with the nooses at various work sites. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. But at the same time, we honestly do have the power to transform the way in which we think. And we either begin that revolution, each of us, or we just simply use the concepts. Jim Crow, for example, some of the absolutely worst representatives in human history, in our history here in the United States. Why in heaven's name would we want to keep using the words they gave us and that they made so much more important and so much more poisonous after the Civil War, both of us having grown up in the 50s and 60s and seen water fountains with the word colored over them.
Yeah. Is the listener still there? You want to?
Well, thank you, sir, for your insights. I just hope that this country can one day realize its greater potential if we adopted your notions of multiculturalism, irrespective of race designation. So thank
well,
you.
I don't know about how you work this in your family. The book is dedicated to my grandson, who is Colombian, Irish, French, Japanese, and Spanish. For me, that little boy is a fantastic fusion. And if anybody badmouths that little boy or asks what he is, they're going to hear from us and our family in everyday life. Mm-hmm. We're simply not going to tolerate this ugliness. And that's a revolution that I think can begin at home.
Yeah. What about at the institutional level? You know, this discussion has got to move, you know, from the hands of us as individuals into our institutions as well.
Absolutely. For example, one of the suggestions that the book makes is for student groups all over the country to call for this national debate about the concept of race, and to do it on Blumenbach's birthday. Blumenbach, of course, the inventor of this word Caucasian. And Blumenbach thought that the most beautiful people in the world came from the southern slopes of the Caucasus Mountains, contemporary Albania. And 15 years later, we're still using that absurd term, Caucasian, simply because of the prejudices that Blumenbach had. So the kids, using the web, using the blogs, can begin this debate. You were asking, for example, about Senator Obama. My hope was that someone like, excuse me, Obama, somebody like Clinton, somebody like Edwards, it can be Huckabee, for my money, can begin this debate about race, and that we really have to have a national conversation and reach a consensus that the word is moronic and that we have to move on. But that the institutions, excuse me, at least the universities, as they did in the 60s, can begin that kind of dialogue. At the same time, I think you have to have affirmative action to deal with the kinds of issues that the law professor just raised, because there is still a lot of poison out there, and a lot of people who want to treat one another miserably because of the prejudices that they've picked up in the process of growing up.
Mm. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
You're talking to an alumni from the University of Connecticut, incidentally.
We all have problems.
Yeah, I did my graduate work there. You can't finish this conversation without mentioning the brown-eyed, blue-eyed study. You know that, don't you?
I think so. Go ahead.
The school teacher who the kids in her third grade, I think it was the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, and she had a little discussion about it, and they were wondering why he was assassinated, and she got into a little demonstration of what it's like to have segregation. And so she divided the class up into brown-eyed people and blue-eyed people. And the brown-eyed people were dumber, they were lazy.
I don't remember this from the
class. Oh, yes, it's a classic study. And these kids just so mean and nasty to the other other people, you know. And then the next day she reversed it.
For her.
Yeah, so that the brown-eyed people now were the smart ones and the blue-eyed people were the dumb ones. There's a film you can get on this. I used to show it to my classes. And she lost her job over that. And she went out and she made a lot of money giving this talk to corporations, because they'd hire her to talk about her experience with that. But that's a classic. If people here haven't seen it or heard about it.
No, thank you very much. Yeah. Sure. It raises the issues, obviously, that we're trying to in the book.
Before we go, I got one last question, and it's a really big one, but I would be interested in your thoughts. The current debate on immigration.
Right.
What do you think, and how does race enter into this contentious debate?
Well, much of it is obviously the issue of being Latino or Hispanic. For me, that's ethnic, not racial. But it's horrible dialogue we're having right now about it. And maybe the last chapter deals with it, particularly in terms of illegal immigration. But if I might, a document I found in some of the research that the book did for the book at the Reagan Library, this document from an assistant secretary of agriculture to the president in 1985, again, this is 85, that the country has been absolutely dependent, totally dependent, that's the exact words, on Mexican labor for 60 years. How can you be totally dependent on a group of people for that long and not being willing to embrace them as a part of who we are as a people? That was, again, 60 years in 85. It's now 82 since we're in 2007. It seems to me that debate is full of so much hypocrisy. There's a memo from Meese to Reagan in 1981 in which Meese discusses the fact that only 15-25% of the illegal population is working in agriculture. That early, fully 75% at a minimum of the illegal population was working in the secondary industries, whether it's doing Romney's lawn or whether it's doing construction. So I guess my answer is, it seems to me we've been so dependent on these folks for so long, and there's something hypocritical at the deepest sense of trying to keep out people who we're simultaneously dependent on.
Mm-hmm. Ronnie, thank you for... Oh, go finish up. Go ahead.
No, not at all. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Ronald Fernandez is a professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Central Connecticut State University. He is the author of America Beyond Black and White, How Immigrants and Fusions Are Helping Us Overcome the Racial Divide. The book is published by the University of Michigan Press as part of its series in contemporary political and social issues.